So, what, 3 days we've been at it? I rather like this sort of gentle camaraderie of meditation together, long afternoon, we're all in the trenches together, fighting Mara, or getting enlightened or whatever. It is a nice feeling, isn't it? Especially for you, probably, because you're not so used to it as we are, but to sit so long, three full hours, and then some walking in between. It's extraordinary effort. And just to try to be still and sustain the practice, that's really, really commendable. And what it developed is, it's not just about the experience you have, whether the experience is difficult or easy, but what you do in that kind of a long session is you develop the foundation for a still mind, for a strong in a good way, mind, a beautiful mind. You develop forbearance. You develop patience. You develop determination. And all these are strengths which I don't think you just get them. Somehow, you go to New World and buy a kilo of whatever, and you don't get them when life is easy either, do you? You don't get endurance when everything's going nicely. You're on the beach in the sunshine, enduring. So there's something about it, it's a kind of almost necessity of having kind of something to work with. Which then doesn't mean we kind of get into self-mortification and run around bare-chested around monsters or something like that. But if you've got a sense that we've been able to sustain general presence for an afternoon or a day, whatever, generally kind of coming back. And we've been able to forbear the painful knees and complaining minds or whatever it might be, and we've been able to maybe calm and still the mind, and that gives a this kind of strength and energy and vitality to the mind, which is necessary for understanding life, isn't it? Because if we are just reacting to life and just sort of, everything comes up and just react all the time with love and hate and so on, there cannot be any insight. Also, if we're just at the thought level, thoughts are very superficial. We're just kind of mulling over our future possibilities or resentments or just fantasizing. Thoughts are very good. And so that affects more deep currents of our consciousness, more deep tendencies of mind, our thoughts are symptoms of deeper things. But we want to get to those deeper things, don't we? So just by kind of coming back to the body all the time, coming back to the present moment, all of that, hopefully, is a kind of shining a light on the way we're made up and what makes us happy, what makes us unhappy. So it's good to kind of reflect on those factors of a practice, not simply the experience. If you just, simply judge the experience, it was good, it was bad, and that's actually a limited understanding of what we're doing on a retreat. There's a lot of good things that go on even if an afternoon's been difficult. The sense of friendship and empathy, I think that's a really nice thing, isn't it? We're doing this together, we're in silence, we're just kind of getting on with our own work, but we're supporting each other by doing the work. And if you had to do this alone, how many would have been able to do an afternoon like that alone? It'd be much, much more difficult. That's a good one. So there's many, many good things that are being developed, many wholesome qualities. And when we talk about right effort, these three factors of the heart, which I was mentioning yesterday, right effort, right mindfulness, right concentration. When we talk about right effort, in the kind of classic way of defining right effort in Buddhism, it's the effort to sustain wholesome states of mind that have arisen and to develop wholesome states of mind that have not yet arisen, and then to abandon unwholesome states of mind that have arisen and to prevent unwholesome states of mind from arising. So it's about wholesome, unwholesome, skillful, unskillful. And we don't talk about, usually in Buddhism, we don't have the references of good and evil. Not so much evil, you know, those are, that's a kind of different perceptual framework. It's more wholesome, unwholesome, kusala, akusala in the Pali, skillful, unskillful, and which is a nice way to look at it. It's not sort of, it's not too heavy with judgment. It's just kind of saying that, well, if you allow this particular unwholesome, unskillful mind state to persist and you don't notice that, then that's going to be an unskillful result. So you don't have to feel guilty about it. You just look at cause and effect and say, well, if I keep kind of looking at this person in an angry way, then that's going to be giving you an unskillful result. So it's a very rational kind of consideration rather than just an emotional rejection, oh, I shouldn't be angry. So when you have that kind of framework of consideration, that's using wisdom. Where sometimes what we use is just a kind of idealism. And idealism quite often sets up a high ideal and then makes a judgment about the way things are. So then we feel guilty or we repress or we try to get rid of and we get very, very confused through our idealism. So attachment to ideals is not really wisdom. It's simply attachment to ideals. Having no ideals, you know, having no goals also would be a shallow life. But having goals, freedom from suffering, freedom from anger, having perspectives like that where one wants to work on himself, but seeing them more in the vein of law of karma rather than in the way of guilt and the attachment to idealism. And most Western meditators that I've met, and probably most Buddhist meditators from both the West and Asia, because the teaching is a very high teaching. It's incredibly hard. I mean, just take Mahayana, you can't get enlightened until everyone else is. It's even more difficult. At least we got a bit easier. So it's a very, very high ideal. And then we can feel always sort of not up to the mark. Oh, I was angry yesterday, or I ate too much yogurt, or you know, whatever we do to ourselves. But that's a kind of form of egotism, a kind of negative form of egotism, where we're always in this comparing mode. I shouldn't be like that, I shouldn't be like that, I shouldn't be like that. Whereas in the way of contemplating right effort and the law of karma, you see something arise and you say, is that skillful? Is that wholesome? Will that lead to my suffering and the suffering of others, or will it lead to my well-being and the well-being of others? It's a different kind of consideration. It's very composed, it's with wisdom. So that's what we mean by right understanding. So right effort it's around wholesome, unwholesome. So to develop the wholesome states of, to sustain wholesome states of mind that have already arisen, wholesome activities, so like sustaining a good, like the five precepts in lay life, sustaining the meditation practice if we already have one, many other things, right? And then bringing forth wholesome states of mind that have maybe not arisen already, and that's what we call bhavana, development. And in the practices of bhavana, in the ways of the heart, what is very much recommended are what we call the Brahma Viharas, which we've been chanting in the mornings. And the Brahma Viharas are, I like to look at them as ways of empathy. I like the word empathy. Empathy is if you consider what empathy is about, it's very non-egotistical, isn't it? Because empathy is really taking away the separateness of me and you, and it's allowing me to kind of to go into your consciousness and say, feel what you're feeling. So when I feel compassion for someone, compassion isn't pity. You know, compassion isn't patronizing. Compassion is truly feeling with what the person is going through. So if you're suffering pain, I feel with your pain. I feel your pain, which is different than say aversion, jealousy, fear, because those states of mind, ego states of mind, are very much alienating, aren't they? Where I'm always against you, or worried about you, or fearful of you, or envious of you, jealous of you. So they're always separative. So the strong ego states, whereas the the Brahma Viharas, which are defined as metta, which is kindness, karuna, which is compassion, mudita, which is empathetic joy, and upekha, which is acceptance or equanimity. We'll talk about those. But they, if you look at that as when your heart is empathetic to someone, be they suffering or happy, empathy is the same. Feeling different. If you're empathetic to them, you don't really suffer. You're with them, and you can offer yourself to them. You can help them, or you can enjoy their goodness or whatever. Whereas if you look at like fear and anger and all those, I like the kind of modern Western world of alienation. How really lonely those states of mind are. You know how really separate you are from life in those ways. Take something like envy or jealousy. And let's say someone has a good job and they have a good family and they go take a vacation in Tahiti and they have a big car and they're good meditators and they've got lots of wisdom and you think, yeah, look at me, it's not fair. That's the kind of, I wish I had. Jealousy is even worse, isn't it? May they drop dead. May they not enjoy their happiness. May they have a flat tire. Okay. So jealousy is an even more removed state of alienation. Envy is, you're pretty lucky. And they're not happy states of mind. They're not happy states of mind. Mudita, empathetic joy, is really kind of feeling, wow, you've really got good karma. You've really got good karma, how nice. And you're really happy for their happiness. That's quite a high state of mind, isn't it? I think we often feel it with children very strongly, don't we? So a child has some success and is really happy with their success, and you know, it's just a little thing, and they're really kind of, their happiness is so pure and so unadulterated and so unaffected, no God, and you kind of really feel happy for the child's happiness. You don't feel threatened by it, with sour grapes. Well, some people are probably stupid enough, but you kind of, you know, that kind of feeling that you have, that's what we mean by empathetic joy. Usually the translations are sympathetic joy. I don't like sympathy because that doesn't fit for me. Empathy fits for me. Empathetic joy. So we can share in the joy of others. But if we feel threatened, if we are insecure, of course. So let's say, I found that when I first started to teach meditation, I started to do retreats and I was a pretty young monk and I really didn't feel confident at all. And then I'd do these interviews and people would be telling me these incredible experiences they're having in meditation. I wish I had some of those. And I feel very threatened, you know. You asking me? You know, I'm actually going to talk tonight. Or, you know, kind of, you know, so I felt very threatened by their success. Because that was, you know, I was supposed to kind of know something. You know. But you can know that. You can observe that, can't you? You can observe that in your heart. And I can't, you know, you can't necessarily get away from it, but you can cultivate. You can cultivate mudita. You can cultivate the feeling of empathetic joy. And how do you do that? Again, as I was explaining, kind of talking earlier, you can do it with memory. So I had a lovely incident where I was on my way to... I probably explained this one to some of you, but I never remember which stories I've told to who anymore. It's all just a jumble, in which country anymore. So, excuse me if you've heard this one before. But anyway, I was at Los Angeles Airport on this last trip back to was it LA? Yeah, back to Toronto, and I had just come from New Zealand, and I had one of those interesting 5-hour waits in Los Angeles Airport that I get, and I was in a lounge, and there was a family. And there was 20 people in the lounge waiting around, and there was a father, kind of a 4-year-old son, and a toddler who was just kind of learning to walk, just walking, really nice, and mom who was ready really big. Mum was ready for another one, right? And Mum was kind of plunked down in the seat, kind of really tired, but kind of looked very contented. And the father was playing with the children, and the little son was playing with the daughter, and they're playing hide and seek with the father. And it was so loving. You know, it was this kind of really, really loving, beautiful family. And I felt a lot of empathy and joy for their love. So that was quite a strong feeling. And I often like to do that. I take the feelings of life and I try to say, well, what's deeper than just the scenario? That's the narrative. But what's deeper than the narrative is my ability to feel for the happiness of others. And that's very skillful. That's a very skillful mind state. That's kusala. So that should be developed. So not only should be maintained, developed. So then I was flying to Toronto or wherever it was, and I just kept bringing that memory up, feeling the heart, and then allowing that memory to become strong. And as I like to joke, I didn't then go out and get married. Well, I need one of those. That's what we sometimes do. If someone else is something nice, you think, well, if I owned that, I'd have that happiness. You don't have to. You can share. You can share in their joy. And that was a very nice meditation. And it really just kind of bringing up that happiness. And then just, but and I find with the practices of the Brahmi Viharas, dwelling in the heart is very, very good, because you do feel those things in the heart. But then, and that's a kind of gift, isn't it? That's the kind of gift that life gives one. But then use that gift, use the gift to make that stronger in one's life. And then that way of empathy, say, that particular way of mudita, then that becomes a strength of mind. The mind has wholesomeness in it. Okay? The mind has a kind of strength in the mind. And when unwholesome tendencies, which are its opposite, like jealousy or envy or feeling intimidated because of other people's success, they become less powerful, or they become more noticed. Because of this other power in the mind, this other strength in the mind. And when they do come up, we don't have to reject them, but we can notice them in the heart, we can see differences. I do that a lot, I like to do that a lot. I like to kind of try to remember like the feelings of when the heart is open, really quite physically. And then when my heart starts to do something else, like close down with what I could feel threatened or envious or whatever, I see, what's the difference? What's the visceral difference? What's the heart difference? What's the narrative difference? What's the real feeling in the heart? What's the difference? And then that becomes really, really nice practice for mindfulness. Where is the heart moving in terms of alienation? And what is the open heart? What is that like? But to do that, one has to make conscious these very natural feelings of empathy. And sometimes what we do is we just say, oh, that was nice, and don't see the deeper significance of that. Because these things can often have a deeper significance, which we miss. It's just nice, it was a nice experience. Ooh, it's gone. So if you're looking, again, if you're looking deeper than the narrative, I keep saying that, deeper than the storyline, deeper than the particulars, to the moods of the mind, the citta, you say. The third foundation of mindfulness, mindfulness of the heart, or mindfulness of the moods of the mind. If you're looking at that more, so that's why I was looking at stream of consciousness, then you'll say, oh, this is really skillful, this is wholesome. But if one's just caught in the narratives of life and the storylines, then it's kind of, you're just sort of up and down with life, but you don't realize deeper meaning in it. And that doesn't mean you're kind of analyzing everything, because that would get boring too. You know, is this meaningful or not? You know, it's not that. It's just kind of getting to a feeling level of life and understanding what that means in terms of karma. So that's mudita. And when we, you know, when we do retreats and so on, oftentimes mudita isn't so much talked about. We usually talk about metta karuna, kindness and compassion. But mudita also is a lovely one to cultivate. And what they say in the texts around sleepiness is to develop mudita, bring up joy into the heart. So if you're feeling dull, think of the little kids in the airport. Make your heart happy. Just as a suggestion, you might bring that into your practice as you're doing the heart practices, and bring in some success in your family, or your, some happiness, or even happiness that you have. This is sometimes we miss it, you know, the good things, the successes you've had, to remember those, to bring a sense of self-love and self-happiness, not as a kind of conceit, you know, oh, I'm wonderful, you know, I meditated for an hour. It's not an egotistical, it's something of the heart. So you're recognizing your own goodness. So that's to be, so if those heart states arise, they're to be sustained, and if they haven't, they're to be brought forth, and that's effort. Right? So when I'm flying from LA to Toronto, and it's pretty groggy actually, because I've just done 12 hours plus 5 hours, so you know, it's pretty messy actually. But then just trying to take, you know, the mind, which is kind of all foggy, and you know, my legs were filled with liquid. I thought I was going to thrombosis or something. And so it's, you know, the kind of environment, it's not very positive. The air's kind of bad and seats are small and so on. It's all right. But then then the mind can just habitually go into kind of dull state or whatever, but to try to make effort to bring forth the wholesome all the time. So there's, because I fly a lot, I do a lot of airport practice, airplane practice. So it's not like just have to do it on the cushion. And that takes an effort to remember wholesome states of mind. It takes an effort to try to figure out how to sustain them, how to manifest them, how to keep them going. And that's what we mean by right effort. So it's not like we greed or with egotism. Karuna is compassion, and where karuna fails, where compassion fails, is when it goes into depression and worry. Now that's a very interesting one to watch with those you really love and really close to, how you can feel a lot of empathy for their suffering, which is compassion, and then that can go into worry or depression or fear, and I've worked a lot with this one with my mother. It's been really instructive for me. How, and I talk a lot about this because it's been so obvious, right? I go see my mom a lot now, and I use that loving relationship to keep making this really strong, this place really strong in my heart, really vibrant. I don't tell her. She wouldn't understand. What are you talking? But I find that really good. And then I observe how if she wakes up in the morning and she's got arthritis, right? I can just see her in her face, the pain, you know, of an 86-year-old body. And then I whoo, and I notice how the open heart goes to actually a closed heart. It's still kind. You know, it's not, I'm not cruel or anything, but it goes into worry. And then I say, well, how can I stay open to her pain and still be attentive to her, not dismissive? And that's when you get into the fourth upekkha, or acceptance. And that's the difficult one in our loving relationships, is the ability to be open-hearted and yet accepting of the inevitable suffering that we all have to face. I found that when my dad was dying, it was it's awful to see someone you love suffering, isn't it? I mean, it's just a terrible thing to look at and have to observe and feel. And yet, I found, kind of being with my dad in the last month of his life, you know, that it really opened my heart a lot to him. It was really, really good. And then as I started to go into worry, I said, yeah, but, you know, he's got cancer. And he's old, and he has to die. It's, I mean, it's a statement of the obvious, but the mind doesn't want to accept that. The mind wants the father to be healthy all the time for 900 years. It's not rational, you know. And so, like, being in those situations is where one is challenged, and that's where you can. That's where you develop these more profound states of mind. The challenge to really develop something like acceptance within compassion. Now, if you didn't have both, if you only had some kind of acceptance without an open heart, you could very easily become dismissive and complacent and cold, couldn't you? On the other hand, if you didn't understand acceptance, then you could also just be worried all the time. Or get kind of a compassion burnout or something like that. See, the Brahma-viharas are really quite profound when you consider them as a whole. If you just take one, I think it misses how they work together. Metta, kindness, is like, it's that general feeling of commonality with the condition of birth and death, with the condition of being a sentient being. So when you consider things in terms of metta, you consider beings in terms of commonness. So you consider that you and I are brothers and sisters in old age, sickness and death. This is the way the Thai monks would often start a talk. We are brothers and sisters in old age, sickness and death. We have, you know, parents. We like comfort. We enjoy being loved. We don't like to be hated, etc., etc. You know, we're the same that way. Which isn't to deny our differences. We are different. We're all different. You know, we have different karma. But there are also the sameness, the commonalities. Now, where metta is very important is when the mind is too discriminating. The discriminating, critical mind always sees differences. You know, you're too big, this is too small, this is bigger. So it's comparative, which is fine. You need a critical mind, that's good. But when the critical mind does not have metta, it really goes off because it just gets into that critical mode. And notice that when you're caught up in a very critical mood, that you just you see fault all the time. If your mind is kind of very critical, it'll just focus on whatever's around. You know, the meditators are too slow, they're too fast, they're too loud, they do this, they do that, and you're doing this, and there's just always criticism. And that's a very alienating, unhappy state of mind. So metta is like beginning to see, well, this is a human being, I'm a human being. This person wants to be happy, I want to be happy. Now metta without the critical faculty can become naive. And that's what we call panya, wisdom. You need wisdom. So you can become very naive, you know, we're all one. And don't lock your car and get your car stolen. The kind of New Age idealism. And I'll trust everyone all the time. Please, come into my house. Why did you take my... We used to keep all our doors open here. We lock them all now. We've lost chainsaws. We've lost donation boxes. We've lost all kinds of stuff, right? So that's the world. You have to be streetwise. Trust in Allah and tie your camel. So that doesn't, you know, sometimes Buddhism can sound really airy fairy. We kind of, we are one and I love everyone and please use me as a doormat. And that's a misunderstanding of metta practice. That's metta isn't about being used by unscrupulous people. Metta isn't condoning people who are immoral. You know, when we use a discriminating faculty, if someone's being immoral, we say, that's wrong, you can't do that. So when the hoons come in, we say, get out. The last retreat we did here, there was Harry lives next door. Harry's got that brown cat that comes around. Harry's got an alcohol problem. So we're all meditating here. It's a beautiful sunny afternoon. Doors are open. And I'm kind of giving an inspiring talk, of course. And Harry comes in, drunk as a skunk. Right? Got his hobnail boots on. His cat comes in first, then Harry. And he's going to sit down right here. So I said, and if you really met the old Harry, may you be real. I said, Harry, get out! Because it would be stupid to let a drunk sit here. And that's, so people sometimes get confused with metta. They kind of like everyone. Oh, you're so sweet, Harry. But then Harry's well behaved. He got out. He left. So you need discrimination. But so how do you use metta? Well, you use metta practice in order to not let your heart get lost in aversion. So if I hated Harry then, and kind of went to his house and banged on his door. If you ever come back again, I'm going to get the cops on you. That would be stupid. And that's, so he has some empathy for Harry, but also Harry, no way, you drink it out. So it's the kind of, it's obvious. Otherwise it wouldn't work. You'd just become, you'd be weak. So you have to be strong. But you can be strong and not be angry. You can do that. So metta is a kind of protection. It's a lovely way to live in non-aversion. So you need both. And so if you find, if you find that you are dwelling in a very critical way towards someone, if you've had a really bad encounter with someone and there's been a lot of betrayal of trust and so on, well then you probably have a lot of anger come up. You just have to be very patient with that. But having processed that, if you find you're always just critical of someone or yourself, just your mind's just very critical. It's not just anger or rage, it's just a bad habit. I didn't put the towel away right, or the shoes off right, or, that kind of just that whinging, negative, critical mind, then that's to be abandoned. In terms of right effort, that's an unskillful state of mind. Don't pursue it, abandon it. And how do you abandon it? Well, all kinds of ways. You can say it twice. Say it really deliberately. They're not cleaning their shoes. Make it absurd. Make it really absurd. This is disgusting. I can't say this anymore. You kind of see it, how absurd, that kind of whinging mind is. Or just stop. Just don't do it. You see that happen? No. I'm not going to do that. I refuse to think that way. Or find another aspect in them. Like sometimes, all of us will have, someone will be grumpy, and you look at them, grump. And then you find out, they've just found out they have cancer. Ooh, poor thing. Your heart changes, from looking at them, and they don't look very happy. I'm not going to like them. And then you find out they're sick, and your heart changes to compassion, because you have some different kinds of information. Well, we can do that deliberately. And say, this person wants to be happy. This person doesn't like to suffer. So you're kind of looking in a kind of human way at their, at who they are. Same with yourself. If you're really, really critical towards yourself, if you're always on your case, as it were, then kind of give it a break. just say, wait a minute. I'm keeping the precepts. I'm trying. I'm not perfect, but I'm trying. I want to be free from suffering. You kind of bring that sensitivity into your own heart. So the fourth of the Brahma, so you have metta, which is kindness, benevolence to all sentient beings. Compassion is karuna, and its downfall is worry. Its opposite is cruelty, obviously. Its opposite is cruelty. Its downfall, it tends to be like worry. Mudita, which is joy, empathetic joy. Its downfall quite often is just getting excited. That can be its downfall. Its opposite is jealousy. And then upekā is a really important one. And upekā is translated as equanimity. And equanimity, I'm using acceptance these days. I just kind of try to find language which fits how it seems to work. It's not the absolute definition, but you can see how much of life is not going to fit our desire patterns, believe it or not. In fact, very little of life fits our desire patterns. So there's much of life which is going to be in some way not the way you want it to be, obviously. And so it's like to actually accept that. So to begin to just like use something like discomfort in a sitting, you just kind of accept discomfort, be with it, rather than just fidgeting and moving around or repressing it or controlling it. Really accept the feeling of discomfort. Now that acceptance isn't just intellectual. It's not as I accept it. That's not acceptance. That's an idea. The idea of acceptance is quite often just idealism. So what happens is that I accept this feeling of anger. I'm perfectly, I accept it completely. No, you haven't at all. You just kind of suppressed it. I completely accept them. I'm not angry at all. But acceptance of anger or pain or whatever is like really welcoming that into the mind and feeling it. That's what acceptance is. Non-acceptance is either rejecting it, distracting it, or thinking about it. And thinking about it isn't acceptance either. So that's why these practices where you get out of your head into your heart, to really accept the feeling of grief, or accept the feeling of depression. Like, depression is a very hard one, isn't it? You get depressed. Many people get very, very depressed. That's very, very tricky to work with, because what I've seen with meditators, if they're really depressed, if they're clinically depressed, meditation doesn't work for them, because they're just sitting there getting depressed, thinking depressing thoughts. So you need some vitality to work with depression. But if you can feel the heart go into depression and not think it, not think depressing thoughts, and really bear witness to it, it's wonderful how it dissolves. And you get this kind of joy that even that isn't going to fool you. Even that mood isn't going to fool you. Whereas if you take depression and you think depressing thoughts, it can really take you down. It can be really a negative spiral, because depression seems so eternal. And then you think eternal depressing thoughts. Oh, this will always be this way. What am I going to do? And then the thinking mind keeps taking you down, 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 down. So then sometimes you just have to kind of do things, do vital things, and get out of a mood. You have to distract the mood. But sometimes you can take something like despair or depression, and you've got enough kind of equipment in place. Sometimes you can't, but sometimes you can. You've got enough equipment, you've got enough practice and confidence and courage to actually, okay, I'm just going to be depressed. Or I'm going to notice depression. You kind of take it as a challenge. And then sometimes, or despair, and then sometimes you can ride it through, and you know it from the beginning, the middle, and end, and you get a lot of confidence that way. Sometimes you can't. Sometimes you just have to, have a cigarette or whatever, or just distract it and then start again. But if you can get those states of mind, then there's a real purification, I found. The times where I've been through deep despairs in monastic life, I've been obviously very, very difficult, but also they've been very kind of profound, because the seeds of those have kind of, I suffered a lot of depression as a kid, or as an adolescent. I can say all adolescents do, but I had the ability to clear a room with my blackness. I could come into a room and be so black, which wasn't nice for me or anyone else. And so I could be so, so heavy. And so it took a long time to understand that. So it was only after kind of being in those that eventually I could get to the point where I could see that heaviness and actually just be mindful of it. And then be mindful of despair and allow it to go through. And mindfulness of despair is different than thinking despairing thoughts. There's a difference, isn't there? Thinking despairing thoughts is just being depressed. There's a difference between knowing depression and being depressed. There's a difference between knowing despair and being despaired. Just as there's a difference between knowing anger and being angry. And that's the difference between the knowing of a mood and the being lost in the storyline and narrative of the mood. And if you get too lost in a mood, then you have to get out of there. You haven't got enough samadhi. So to kind of say that one can do everything with awareness or whatever is sometimes a bit naive. When we started teaching in England, we thought, well, meditation will cure everything. Well, were we ever naive? Because some people, just their mind states are so heavy and difficult and negative that they get overwhelmed by them. So they need other things. They need to break those mind states. Sitting on a cushion doesn't necessarily work. In general, what you need is the vitality of samadhi. And the vitality of samadhi is like the ability to be with the way things are without getting caught in the thoughts. If one doesn't have that, like if you're really angry at someone, and you keep believing in the anger, then it's best just to get away from that. But if you're really angry with someone, you can notice the anger, then you can understand a lot about anger. Right? Same with depression or whatever it might be. So acceptance then, acceptance is not condolence. And it's not just kind of passive too, there's a vitality in acceptance because the mind is bright and I know, the mind knows what's going on. So it's not just kind of, you know, kind of couch potato, oh I accept, I feel depressed. Turn on the TV for 5 hours, yeah I feel depressed. That's not what we mean by upekkha. It's a lot more profound than that. Ultimately, I think acceptance is empathy with Dharma. Because Dharma is the way things are, right? And all things that arise because of causes, and they cease when those causes cease. So true acceptance is saying, well, this is just the law of karma. So if I feel, you know, if I've done things in my life, so like I smoked a lot of marijuana and did naughty things like most people in the 60s. So when I got into the monastery, and I had a lot of terrible, I didn't have any samadhi because my mind was filled with smoke and other chemicals. So how was I going to get any samadhi until I just sort of wore some of that karma? So I suffered, some depression because of that. It's a lot of karma. So like empathy with that, empathy with my, having lived morally, then that was a karmic result of that. But what could be other than that? And so the acceptance of that. So the law of karma sometimes is very good for bringing up acceptance. I was speaking to someone earlier about a friend I've got in Bangkok who is a gem merchant, and he was one of the first disciples of Ajahn Chah, Siri, and he was a good tailor up in Ubon when the American Army was making lots of bucks. And then the American Air Force left after the Vietnam War. He lost his work and he went down to Bangkok and became a gem merchant. And he had this older guy who was this kind of guru in the gem trade. And this older guy taught him the gem trade, and Siri himself became quite good at it, and he became fairly wealthy. And about 10 years down the road, his guru went to him and said, I'm in really bad shape, my business is really, really bad, I need a lot of cash, I'm really short. And Siri gave him all his liquid assets, which was several million baht, without a chit, without a note, without anything. Just out of trust. The guru went to the States and never came back. So that's Siri about a year later, 2 years later, something like that. 2 years later, something like that. I said, are you still angry? And he said, well, I was angry for about a year. And then I thought, well, I probably owed him 2 million baht from a past life. And he let it go. Which is a really, really nice story how somehow he just rationally accepted it. I'm sure for the first few months he probably was plotting how he was going to kill the guy. So he probably got through that bit. So acceptance, kind of karma, things like that. So equanimity is quite a difficult one to develop. But it has to be developed with heart. So the other three are also very important. Okay, I'll leave that for tonight.